This is the Athletic NBA Show, The Young Ones. We've got the Riz God, Tim Cato, joining in for a special episode because Luka Doncic went absolutely insane the previous evening. Before we get to that, we got Will Guillory. I'm Jared Weiss. Probably should say who I am. Law Murray's here. Jovan Buha's here. Tim, you witnessed greatness. How great was it?
It was quite great. I've witnessed a lot of greatness when it comes to Luka Doncic, and this was levels above. Dude had 60-20-10. We're not talking about, is this Luka's best game ever? It is. We're talking about, is this the best game, at least regular season game, in NBA history? And there's a case to be made that it is. Obviously, I think you're going to end up putting 100-point games, you know, 81 from Kobe, stuff like that, a little bit above it. But we're talking top 5, top 10 performance ever. And I think the circumstances of how it happened, that the Mavericks won that game in a situation where 13,000 teams had come before, you know, with a 9-point lead and 33 seconds remaining. All of them had lost. They had a 9-point deficit, the Mavericks did. All of them had lost. And because Luka is Luka and he's going to do something, you know, divine and holy and whatever that was last night, the Mavericks win. And it's just incredible, man. I'm still trying to process it all.
Yeah, this is one of those things where people say, man, you couldn't even do this on 2K if you tried to. I literally think this is one you couldn't do on 2K if you put the game on rookie. And I think you brought up the moment there where he misses the free throw at the end of the regulation, gets his rebound. Do you think that'll go down as the most memorable moment from this game? What do you kind of look back on last night and say my most memorable moments from this game?
I think the most memorable moment is Luka saying that he needs a recovery beer on the court seconds afterwards. I think this is going to be the recovery beer game. Like, you've got the flu game, you've got the flu recovery game. Well, this is the beer recovery game. But yeah, I think you're right that I know everybody listening to this has probably seen Luka's game tying shot. Go watch it again. And this dude jumps off the floor. So first off, he executes the missed free throw perfectly. And it comes off the rim in the right way, and it bounces around, ricochets, and he grabs it with one outstretched hand. He is already looking at the basket. He brings the ball into his other hand to gather, brings it down, brings it back up, shoots it from about 10 feet. So we're not talking an easy putback. He's about 10 feet away, and he has the touch to put that shot in to tie the game. And he does this without, like, in one jump. He's still up in the air from his first jump of gathering the ball to when he shoots it to when it goes in, and he's landing right there. It's an incredible, incredible shot that I think is just a summation of so many things and aspects of his game that makes him good. I think are represented in that moment.
Law, I know we had a lot of great moments in this game, but where does his celebration when he thought he hit that game winner rank at the end of overtime?
Best damn thing he did. Best damn thing he did the entire night. I mean, it looked like he was having a spasm. It looked like he wasn't going to be able to play overtime. Recovery beer was needed as soon as he tied the game.
That should be legal. You should be, every NBA player should be allowed to drink one beer between the end of regulation and overtime.
Okay, yeah, Jovan,
especially if you hit a shot like that.
Jovan, if you had to take one shot of something to prepare yourself for overtime, what would it be? And you can't say cold brew.
I was going to say, probably vodka.
Why vodka? Because it's most disgusting?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's my Eastern European roots that vodka just, that's my most tolerable alcohol.
Well, you're more Serbian. Do you have liquor. A recovery beer?
I could have a recovery beer, yeah. But I think I would want a shot of vodka.
Fair enough.
So I don't drink Fireball anymore, but I feel like Fireball is the answer here.
I mean, that was Luka in the fourth quarter, right?
With some Jaeger? No.
Jaeger would actually make a lot of sense.
Okay.
Yeah, I did Jaeger once in my life, and that was the last time I plan on doing Jaeger in my life. So,
me as a teetotaler listening to all this.
I had friends that they would like line their kitchen cabinets in college with like empty Jaeger bottles. I would just get traumatized every single time that I walked to that house.
So I'm gonna say one more thing about the celebration, and it's that I saw it described last night as cute. I saw somebody describe it as cute. And I think that, like, we love and we hype up players who are just ice cold and players who are just, like, stone cold killers. And I think there is something to Luka. He's got the boyish face, you know, he's got the beard that clearly is a 23-year-old's beard. You know, he says, like, goofy stuff, like, dorky stuff, like, I gotta get a recovery beer, you know, in post-game interviews. This is a guy who, you know, it's not that he doesn't know how good he is. It's just that, like, he's like, I don't know why I'm this good. Stop asking me. I'm just gonna be me. And I think that's a really cool thing. That's when I wrote about it on The Athletic. You can read it now. It's up there. And I really tried to focus on, like, he did something great. Like, we just saw greatness, and I think we want to understand greatness, right? Like, I think that's a very human instinct. And Luka can't explain it any more than us. It's not some aspect of, you know, it's not his, you know, 99th percentile work ethic, or, you know, it's not because he has the most unstoppable jumper. He just, you know, he's just like, I'm this good, and I'm not going to have the words to explain it any better than me, you know, than you or I. And so that's really what I came away, you know, from that game thinking, that, you know, there's nothing to do but just enjoy that Luka Doncic is this good at basketball, and it's really fun to watch.
Well, we're in this weird spot in the NBA where, like, if you look at arguably the top four or five MVP candidates, it's like you have Luka and Jokic, who are these guys that look like they're out of shape, beefy as hell. They play at the slowest pace possible. They try to almost play slower than everybody else. That everybody else just kind of runs past them, and then they can just kind of shoot or pass or do whatever through anything as if no one's there. Then you got guys like Giannis and Tatum, who are these, like, absolute athletic specimens who seem to have infinite athleticism and stamina and length. And it's, I think, what makes a guy like Luka so fascinating is because you can clearly understand why a guy like Giannis or Tatum would be better than everyone, just because you can just see in their builds and they're so chiseled and they're so fast. And Luka, it's like him and Jokic, they both make plays that every time they make the play, you're like, this is not going to work. And
yeah, I'm just glad you didn't throw Zion in the beefy out of shape guys category. We've come a long way.
I mean, he's both beefy and he's infinitely athletic. He's kind of a paradox.
He's the best of both worlds.
But Will, you've been watching Zion up close, and I feel like Zion is making that MVP discussion push right now. But after watching what Luka did, do you see, like, a gap between where Zion is and kind of, like, to be an MVP, it's like you have to control the game and read the game in a way. And, like, do you still see that gap for Zion to close?
Yeah, because, I mean, people still forget that Zion still hasn't played that many games, right? It feels like he's so dominant that it feels like he's been doing this for a long time, but the guy's still under 150 career games. I mean, Luka has been dominant for years and years now, multiple playoff series. Same thing for Giannis, Tatum, all of those guys. So Zion still has so much more room to grow, which makes his dominance up to this point even more crazier. But, yeah, I think that's the next step for Z, is kind of – understanding the game and being able to control every single nuance the way Luka does. But I mean, nobody does it quite like Luka. And I think that's what's so interesting about Tim's coverage of the Mavs, is because, like, we see this guy is on the path to becoming one of the greatest players ever. And you're trying to capture that through every one of these, you know, historic moments he has. And, you know, I'm starting to get there with Zion, but I think, Tim, that's such an interesting thing for you, having a front seat for this guy where he's right at the takeoff, right, of where he's headed, and we see where he's going. I mean, what's that like for you sitting there in that arena every game and seeing, you know, him putting this resume together to become one of the best players to ever do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's I try not to take it for granted, but I did last night. I left my seat. I thought the game was over. I watched the, you know, shot he made from a TV in the hallways outside the press conference room, because I was like, oh yeah, this is over. Because again, 14,000 times this exact game has happened and it was over. So, like, I was playing the odds and I thought we were safe. And then yet he goes out and does this. And so what's crazy is just, you know, he's been doing this for so long. You know, we asked him last night, and I'm going to actually write about this later this week, but we asked him last night if he had ever had, if Luka had ever had a 60-point game before, and he said he hadn't. Like, he couldn't, you know, not even at youth tournaments, you know, not throughout his European career. And you think about it a little bit, and it makes sense because, first off, you know, FIBA rules, like, they play shorter games over there, stuff like that. He's never been a player who is playing above his talent. Like, he's always been the 8-year-old trying to play in the U12 teams and the 16-year-old playing in the second best, you know, playing for the best non-NBA team, you know, in the world, for Real Madrid. And he's always been upping his game in a way that he's just continued doing at the NBA level. So it's not like he was ever 17, you know, scoring for fun against other 17-year-olds. At 17, he was, you know, playing against ex-NBA players who were 29 years old, you know, who had been in NBA weight rooms and locker rooms and, you know, had grown man strength. And for him to just carry over exactly, you know, kind of the ascendancy that he had throughout his teenage years just directly to the NBA and now what he's doing in his fifth season, where, you know, I think after this, you know, it almost feels, you know, small to talk about MVP narratives and stuff like that, you know, because of just how ridiculous that game was. But, you know, I have to think that he's going to be vaulting to the top of those just because of the stakes of this game and the way he did it. But it's just incredible, man. And it's something I really try to appreciate, being able to watch it so closely.
So, I mean, all of us are covering, I guess, either an MVP candidate or someone who was the best, or an MVP candidate or the best player in the league at one point. And they're all at different stages. So I guess Law and Jovan, go to you two guys. You know, this, like, Cato's story and this whole moment was about understanding greatness. And so, Law, you cover Kawhi. You also cover Luke Kennard. You understand greatness at a certain perspective. Jovan, you have LeBron, AD. You have Austin Reeves. Like, you guys have seen greatness at different levels. Law, do you have an understanding of, like, as being around Kawhi, covering Kawhi, I presume talking to Kawhi at some point, has that helped you understand, like, what greatness looks like in one of its various forms?
It definitely does. And it is from the total opposite perspective of what Tim Cato gets to see. I'm never going to see anybody score 60 on this damn team, like, ever. I mean, shoot, I think the Clippers have maybe one 40-point game from a guy this year. When you look at Kawhi, I mean, it took Kawhi until I saw you in LA, Jared, for him to even score 20 in a game, okay? Like, and that was December 12th. So it took Kawhi 2 months into the season just to do that. You know, the weekend after that Celtics game, he scores his first 30-point game. And Kawhi is completely unbothered by that, because Kawhi's greatness is not in what is produced from a point standpoint. He's about playing the game the right way and raising the IQ of everybody on the floor with him. That's why his Kawhi's plus minus is crazy right now in only 14 games. I mean, the Clippers outscore teams about 8 points per game when he's on the floor. And that's just a matter of, he's just going to make the right play every time. And that's his dedication to greatness. Is he's basically the next coming of Tim Duncan in his form. Like, he's so unimpressed with what he's able to do. He is so concerned about doing everything the right way. Even if that means he's not shooting it, he's just going to move it and not be involved in the final play, the hockey assist. That's what I'm seeing. And again, completely different than what Tim gets to see, but a similar level of appreciation nonetheless.
I think as we're talking about this, it's kind of dawning on me that we each have guys at different points in terms of, like, you know, Luka's still on the rise, even though obviously he's already there, but, like, he's going to get even better. And I think that's kind of the specialness, the greatness with him. Kawhi, I guess, is still kind of in his prime. I mean, probably back end of his prime, but still, I think, firmly in his prime as he's getting his legs back under him. And with LeBron, it's like he's fighting father time, and he's doing things that are just unprecedented. And I recently wrote this after the Christmas game, but, like, He's in year 20, averaging over 36 minutes a game. Some other notable players in year 20, Kobe, 28 minutes a game. That's an 8-minute difference. That's a huge difference. Kareem, 22 minutes a game. Vince Carter, 17 minutes a game. Like, and really, there aren't many guys who actually played 20 years in the NBA. So, but like, just like LeBron's workload and for him to be putting up 26, 8, and 6 in year 20 is just, it's just something we've never seen before. At the same time, he's kind of in a different position than the Mavericks and the Clippers, where the Lakers are 6 games under 500. And this is kind of another wasted season for LeBron, you know, back to back kind of duds where this team might win, you know, 30 something games. And it's just like it's kind of sad to see. And I think, you know, just objectively as an NBA fan and NBA historian, like seeing who I think is either the second or best player of all time kind of go out like this, it's just, you know, you kind of wish it was under different circumstances. And I'm not going to play the blame game, because that was kind of the reaction to the piece. Was like, whose fault is it that LeBron is going out this way? Is it LeBron's fault? Is it the front office, ownership, like, you know, Russell Westbrook? Like, everyone's pointing the finger. But for me, it was more just, you know, we all love basketball, obviously. That's why we're all doing this. And it's just, it kind of sucks to see him go out in the way that he's going out right now. But it's also a testament to him that he's still this great, and we're still having this conversation of, like, you know, he's not an MVP candidate by any means, but he's still in that top 10, I think, for sure. And it's crazy that he's about to be 38 in 2 days, and we're still having this discussion.
And I think that's the next step in this greatness conversation, because we know in the NBA, these great players are more powerful than they are probably in any other league. And I think the Lakers and Clippers are two examples of where the star players just grab so much power. And I think the Mavs and the Pelicans are in very similar shoes, where they're looking at those situations and saying, do we want to give our stars that much power over our franchise? Because are we going to end up where those teams are? And I think the Clippers are probably in a slightly better situation than the Lakers. But I think that's the next step, especially with a guy like Luka, who's really reaching the highest height of his greatness, maybe much more than a guy like Zion, where it's like, okay, this guy is this great, and of course he should have some voice in the franchise. But how much of a voice should we give him, and how much is that going to hurt us in the future or help us? Because you get to keep this guy around, and as long as he's around, you're going to be great. But at what point does that kind of, you know, have diminishing returns?
And to me, that's the cool thing about basketball, is that it is uniquely set up. It is the, you know, out of all the most popular team sports, it's got the smallest number of players, and it's the one where one player, you know, outside of, I guess, quarterback in NFL, where one player can make such a oversized impact on what actually happens and what we see. And it just allows greatness to be defined and to be visible in a way that I think has a uniqueness to the sport of basketball. And to me, at least, it's why I, you know, have gravitated towards this sport over all others. And it's why it's the one I've chosen to work in and to cover and to ultimately spend the most time thinking about and talking about and watching.
I think that's my concern when I do see Luka put up 60 and 20 rebounds and 10 dimes to save the Mavericks from a shorthanded Knicks team. You know, what we were talking about last year was Zion, and Will, I told you this, like, this time last year, Zion wasn't playing and the Pelicans were just trying to dig out of last place in the entire Western Conference, right? Zion, Luka, even Nikola Jokic to a point, they are in the prime of their careers, right? The nut graph of their careers, if you want to call it that. And that's the privilege that they have, because they ain't a whole lot else to do, damn it. Like, ball out while you can, while you have that perfect mix of experience and physical talent, right? But then you look at Luka and it's like, man, Jalen Brunson should, you know, was on this team last year and they went to the Western Conference Finals. Are they, like, what's it going to take for that team to even match that? Are they even going to avoid the play and stuff like that? I mean, Zion's team is in a great shape because of the roster construction, right? Luka doesn't have that privilege. Like, where are the assets? Where's the improvement coming from? Where are the guys? Like, does Luka have to do this just for them to tread water, right? And that's where it's like, Luka's MVP discussion is the Russell Westbrook MVP discussion from 2017. Russ was doing some crazy things that we had never seen before. And we were like, oh my God, he's GOAT forever. And in one stance, he's right. But damn it, how many playoff series has Russell Westbrook won since KD left Oklahoma City? And Luka and his and where he's at right now with his teammates, with the fact that no lottery picks before him are still there. And damn it, Luka was too good for them to have lottery picks now, you know, or after he got there. What's next? How does this get better? And I'm not saying, you know, like this isn't a ring chase discussion or anything like that. You know, I'm not bringing that up. I'm just bringing up the fact that, man, Luka's got to be great just for the Mavericks to have a chance. And what is that chance really looking like right now?
I know we're talking regular season, but my one pushback on that is already, I think from Luka, we've seen a level of greatness in the playoffs that we never really saw from Russ, or we more saw from Russ as kind of a sidekick. Like, I think that's been, I'm so kind of in the Russ situation because of the Lakers stuff, but like, I think really the one knock on Russ, like to take out the Lakers situation, I think it's just been his playoff performances, right? And like, it just, you go year by year, his numbers drop in the playoffs basically every year. And it's efficiency, it's just overall production. And like, I covered Luka in the bubble, you know, was not at the bubble, but covered that series against the Clippers. I know you've seen Luka firsthand. Tim has, obviously, like in the playoffs, playoff Luka is even better. Like it's insane. Like he went toe to toe twice with Kawhi and PG, and they really didn't have an answer for him other than just the Clippers being the better, more complete, team. And so I know MVP is regular season, and we are like, I think there is some kind of correlation with him and Russ in that sense. But like, I guess the way I kind of view it, you know, differently in that is that I think Russ, there's a little bit more of an empty calorie kind of essence to that. Whereas with Luka, I think there's something more, because I think we've already seen that as a young guy, really, other than maybe young LeBron, young Magic, young Bird, young Jordan, like there aren't many guys that have played to that level this early into their career.
Yeah, and to your point, I was going to just say real quick, just to your point, Jovan, like the playoff performances and everything, Luka's stamped there. I'm talking about the team around him. That's the only part that I'm saying, like the team around him, who is going to help and compliment him.
Yeah, and that was the point I was going to make. I think the better comparison is probably LeBron in Cleveland 1.0, right? Where we see this guy as like transcendent, great, and like he's able to carry this team to heights that they shouldn't get to when you look at the other four guys in the starting lineup. But at what point does that star guy say, hey, like, I need another guy to help me out so we can get to the next level? Because at some point, Luka's going to put up all these great numbers. He's going to continue to be great in the playoffs. We know that. But we know how conversations go in the NBA. If you don't have that ultimate prize behind your name, if you don't make it to the finals, if you don't get that ring, then people are going to start doubting you. People are going to start questioning your greatness. And guys get tired of that after a while. And I think Luka's at the point now where he's still enjoying it. They had the conference finals run last year, so that's bought them some time. But I do think at a certain point, that pressure is going to grow as his greatness continues to grow. And what's the path to get Luka to that point where he can eliminate those conversations about can he win at the highest level?
Kato, what do you think? Let's just wrap this Luka discussion here. What do you think Luka wants, and like what motivates him? What does he respond to? It seems like he's a pretty winning focused person at this point. Doesn't seem like he wants anything besides his recovery beer and his W.
Yeah, recovery beer, dude. Just like make sure that you got a full fridge, and you got some lagers, you got some IPAs, you got to mix it up a little bit. And yeah, dude, it's Luka wants to have fun. I think if I were to really boil it down, and now having fun, there's a lot included in that, and it definitely includes winning. And I don't know how much it includes having the basketball at all times. I think that, you bring in the right pieces, you have the right co-star next to him, and it would be really easy for him to play a more democratic version of basketball and still be great and still have this greatness that we see, you know, just maybe not in 60-point, you know, performances all the time, you know. But I think that's what Luka wants, and I think that, to me, really defines why he is such a fascinating, why I'm so drawn to covering him in the way he is just this idea that, you know, he's just a guy who's always done this, and he's always done this because he's always had more fun doing this than anything else he could be doing. And if that's not, you know, kind of the ethos and the through line of sports and why we care about them and why they matter and why, you know, we keep trying to understand them, then, you know, what is? And so, you know, every player who has greatness represents sports in their own manner, and to me, that's the way Luka does it, and that's what makes him special.
We're lucky to have such an ethereal, enigmatic thinker like Tim Cato covering such an ethereal, enigmatic point guard like Luka Doncic. We are luckier at The Athletic. Make sure you read his story. It's great. It's weird as hell. It's very much Luka-esque, and you're gonna need a recovery beer after reading it. All right, when we come back, the one and only Andrew Schlecht, our producer for the show, he's going to catch up with the Riz God himself, Shams Charania. You are listening to The Young Ones on The Athletic NBA Show.
Welcome to The Inside Pass with Shams Charania, presented by American Express. I'm your host, Andrew Schlecht. Shams, let's first start in Indiana. We've heard a lot of rumors about Miles Turner trades in the past, but what are you hearing about the possibility about a contract extension with the Pacers?
What's developed really in the last few weeks is that the Pacers and Miles Turner have opened up contract extension talks. They're exploring a pathway to a potential new deal. And I do think there is a level of you know, motivation on both sides to try to get a deal done. This is a guy, Miles Turner, who, like you said, he's been in the Willie or won't be traded for the last several years of his career and his Pacers tenure. And I think now he's playing his best basketball, playing well with Tyrese Halliburton. And the Pacers have the unique ability. They have $25 million in cap space. They can give him about $19.1 million on top of his current salary. That puts him at about $37 million for just this season alone. And then have a drop off from there in a new extension. So we'll see if they can reach an agreement on a new deal, but that's what they're working toward and seeing if there's a pathway. I think the Pacers still keep an open mind if someone blows them away in a trade. But right now they are talking on an extension.
Let's move on to the Kings, where their all-star center, Domantas Sabonis, who's been a huge reason for the success this season, has suffered a right hand injury. Shams, what are you hearing about his potential timetable for return?
So it's an avulsion fracture of a ligament in his thumb. And from what I'm told, it sounds like basically the ligament fractured off of the bone in his hand by his thumb. And this is an injury that some players get surgery, some players can try to play through it. He, for right now, is trying to play through it. He's listed questionable tonight against Denver. And I think the goal right now, if he misses tonight, if he misses a few games, is to get himself in a position where he can play through this and get on the court and stay on the court and try to not have surgery.
The Red Hot 76ers, who've won 8 in a row, are on the verge of getting their young electric guard Tyrese Maxey back. Shams, what are you hearing about Maxey's return to the lineup?
Maxey will be back in the Sixers lineup this weekend, most likely on Friday. If not, it'll be Saturday against Oklahoma City. They have a back-to-back in New Orleans on Friday, in OKC on Saturday. And this is a major return. This is a guy we haven't seen on the court since November 18th when he had that fracture in his foot. He's missed a little bit more time than I think initially expected, but now he is on the cusp of a return, and it's at a time where the Sixers are playing their best basketball of the season, 8-1 in their last 9 games, 8-game winning streak. And so they're going to reintegrate him back. He could come off the bench to start, but definitely will be on a minutes restriction, at least initially upon his return.
Are there any thoughts to him being in that 6-man role, or do you expect him to be a starter once everything gets rolling?
Well, if they try to see how he looks coming off the bench, you never know how that plays out. Could this team continue to click better? You know, with D'Anthony Melton starting right now with James Harden, that keeps the ball in Harden's hands and Embiid's hands. And then Tyrese Maxey could theoretically lead a second unit. But I know the weight. I mean, he's averaging 23 points per game this year, over 40% three-point shooting. This is a guy that the Sixers really, really believe is going to be a star player. So we'll see where the roles shake out.
always, go read Shams Charania and his Inside Pass at theathletic.com. And thanks so much for listening to the Inside Pass with Shams Charania, presented by American Express. Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
All right, that was Shams and Schlecht. We are back here. Let's wrap up Young Ones talking about Will's team, because the Pels are endlessly fun. They are, as of Wednesday, a game back of the Nuggets. Just give me a breakdown of the state of affairs with the Pels right now, Will.
It's really insane, because this season in some ways has been very similar to Pelican seasons I've covered in the past, where they came in with heavy expectations and then injuries came through and just completely changed the lineups we expected to see. And in the past, that usually results in a lot of losses for the Pels. But this season, they've had their projected starting lineup for 10 games total, and they're still number two in the West somehow. They won the last three games, I believe, and without Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson. B.I. has missed like a month now with this toe injury, and it's not even a factor. They've been playing their best basketball of the season without him. It's insane. I think this team has a real argument for the deepest roster in the NBA. And it's wild, because we came into the year thinking, man, Zion Williamson, B.I., C.J., they've got such a high power top three. And the reason they're sitting at number two in the West right now is because of everybody else on the roster, how much they've carried this team. And I think David Griffin deserves a ton of credit for what he's done to build out this roster, to find guys like Najee Marshall, Jose Alvarado, Herb Jones, all of these dudes who we had no idea who they were before they came into the league. And now they're making a huge impact on this squad. And it's going to be crazy to see, once they're fully healthy, how many of these guys are going to continue to play, because it's going to be hard to take some of them out of the rotation.
The Clippers and the Pelicans are kind of neck and neck here. They're both really deep squads, a little bit different in their setup, but pretty similar. I mean, you've seen this Clippers team kind of hit that ceiling over and over and over again, but obviously health is a big part of it. What do you see in this Pelicans team that makes you optimistic that they could break through that?
Man, I saw the Pelicans and the Clippers in April, okay? And I mean, the two times I went to New Orleans last season and got to see my guy Will, I mean, both of those games were before the Pelicans even made the trade with Portland. And I just saw New Orleans and their physicality. Again, this was without Zion, just beat the hell out of the Clippers. And so what it reminds me of is the Memphis Grizzlies the year before. They got in the play-in, they were the ninth seed. They eliminated the Golden State Warriors to make the playoffs. The Pelicans did the same thing this past year. Now, you saw the Grizzlies jump from a play-in team to number two in the West last year, and a damn good number two. The Pelicans are doing this exact same thing a year later. And to Will's point, they're deep. They have the health questions. So it's like, you want to know exactly how good the connection between Brandon and Zion is going to be. Obviously, CJ is another part to that. But I just admire Willie Green. They're well coached and they're together. It's not just what they do to beat you. And we're talking about one of the most well-rounded teams in the entire league, certainly the West, as far as what they do on both ends of the floor. It's the fact that they give a damn about each other. It's the fact that they are going to still play hard, like they haven't, you know, like they still have something to accomplish. And that's what makes a team scary. You know, it's one thing to be good and talented and have so many good players and to be, you know, smart and prepared. But that's another thing to actually give a damn and to just have that X factor of caring. And I think that's what makes New Orleans scarier than anything else.
So what makes the Pelicans so fascinating is I feel like maybe 2 years ago, we were looking at them as like a lot of high potential guys that are in the early part of the development pipeline. And now, like you were talking about, with even Marshall starting to become like an important part of this rotation, they're so deep with good young role players and guys that I don't really see them becoming feature part of the offense or whatever, but they are rounding their games out. You know, Trey Murphy is rounding his game out. You know, obviously Alvarado is just like one of the revelations of the NBA this year, even though he was last year. It's like this year, it's another huge leap forward. I mean, Will, how much has their player development almost like surprised you? And is there more room for them to grow? Or is this just one of those things of like, they're actually better than we realized they were now that they're in a good cohesive team?
No, there's no doubt those guys can get better. Because like I said before, Zion's still in the beginning stages of his greatness, right? He's still learning how to be great. So he's got more levels to go. And like Law said, they still got work to do to find out the chemistry between Z and B.I. But the crazy thing you said, it's been a revelation this year, but it started with last year. And, you know, last year when they were going through that rough slide where they were 3-16 to start the year and we had no idea what was going on with Zion and it looked like everything was about to implode. I remember going to games 2-3 hours before tip and watching Jose Alvarado, Najee Marshall, Trey Murphy, Jackson Hayes, all these guys playing in pickup games and seeing the work they were doing and seeing just how much energy they brought to the floor when it was a completely empty arena. It was just them and the assistant coaches. And you saw kind of this thing they were building. And I was like, man, is this just ended up bench guys that you see all the time doing great things? Is like we're all used to being covering the NBA. You watch like a James Jones on the end of the bench and it's like that guy can't play, and then you watch him in warmups and he makes 23s in a row. Or is it like these guys are actually good? And I think you saw after a while, once those guys got an opportunity, that they were actually good. And you see with Jose Alvarado, he's not just the guy who hides in the corner and gets steals. He's scored 38 in the game this year. You know, Trey Murphy is more than just the guy who can get hot against the Clippers in the playing game and hit some threes. He's expanded his game, and you can go down the line. Najee Marshall has expanded his game, and I think their player development, you go Corey Brewer, Teresa Weatherspoon, I can name a bunch of names who people don't know, but I think they've done an incredible job building up these guys. And I think a huge thing is just the chemistry they have in the locker room. It's unlike anything I've been around. We've all been in NBA locker rooms and you're used to seeing a click over here, a click over there, the international guys over in the corner doing their thing. It's not like that in the Pelicans locker room. All of those guys rock with each other. They all are like best friends. They love each other every single day, every single shoot around. It seems like the first day of school, and I don't understand it, how they can keep the energy going, but they've maintained it. And that's why I think they feel so confident in these games when Zion doesn't play, when B.I. doesn't play, because they're like, all of these guys are talented and we're all playing for each other. So we feel like we're going to be able to get a win regardless of who we're playing or who's suiting up on this side. And you got to give a ton of credit to Willie Green just for what he's done to build up the chemistry and the belief in that locker room. Because I was around in 2020 when Stan Van Gundy was the coach, and that didn't exist whatsoever within that locker room. Those guys didn't like coming to work. They didn't like being around each other. They didn't know how they were going to win from night to night. And it's completely turned in a year and a half, basically. And it's been wild to see.
All right, let's go from one team that seems to win no matter who they have in the lineup to a team that can't win, even though they have everybody pretty much half the time. So right now, I know AD is out, but the Lakers, they've had their chances this year to prove that they could be a better team. And looking at them now, Jovan, they are 2.5 games behind Golden State as of Wednesday. Portland, Utah, Sacramento, none of these teams are falling off. So where, like, how do Lakers fans feel right now? Are they angry? I can't imagine they'd be angry. Are they angry right now?
I will direct you to the comment section on my last story if you want to know how Laker fans are feeling right now. It's interesting because the fan base is so, like, all over the place. Like I think you could interview 10 different Laker fans and you would get 10 conflicting, totally different perspectives on what's going on with this team right now, and again, whose fault it is, and what's the best solution. The biggest thing all season has been, are they going to make a trade? And I think entering the season, it was clearly an imbalanced roster. It's a very guard-heavy team. They don't have a lot of playable guys who are over 6'5". And I think the implication, and kind of based on you know, my reporting, other people's reporting, like, they were going to trade Russell Westbrook before the season. And that, you know, they ultimately pivoted and decided not to do that. Then it became November, Thanksgiving, then December 15th. And now it's getting pushed back probably closer to the trade deadline. And, you know, I think right now there's also a chance they just don't make a move at all. And, but it's just been really weird to watch because they just have a roster that, you know, again, doesn't really make sense. It feels like you're watching cookie dough out there. And you know that, you know, it's got to be baked and it's got to turn into an actual cookie. But like this is kind of like they play a lot of lineups where there's literally like three guys 6'2 and below on the court. And it's just like it's almost the anti-modern NBA. And then there's also no shooting out there as well. So I think for them, that's kind of been the thing. Recently, I mean, AD was playing at Lakers record wasn't good enough, but he was playing as arguably the best player in the league, you know, top three player at that time before he went out. He had that, you know, six or seven straight games with 30 and 15. He was just dominating people in the paint. LeBron, over the past couple weeks, he just had seven consecutive games with 30 plus. He's looking like himself again. So it's just this weird situation where you have two guys who at their peak when healthy are probably both top 10 guys. And this team's not even in the play-in tournament right now. So it's, you know, the supporting cast is one of the worst in the league. I know we joke about it, but aside from Austin Reeves, who's probably been their third best player this season, you got Lonnie Walker, you got Bench Russ, and everyone else has been inconsistent at best. So I think for the Lakers, it really comes down to, are they willing to give up a pick or two? Because that's what it's going to take on, you know, Pat Beverly or Kendrick Nunn or Russ. And is it even worth it? Is it even like, is this season even salvageable? If you go trade for Bojan Bogdanovic, like does that get you in the play-in tournament at this point? With we still don't even know, you know, how long AD is going to be out officially yet. So I think that there's been more questions than answers with this team all season. And it feels like something that's really going to come up to the trade deadline, whether they make a move or not. And again, even if it's even worth making a move at that point, you know, where they are in the play-in mix.
It's funny. My bad, Jared. And I'm glad you brought up AD because I feel like that might be the most interesting thing going on with this team because his injury is so mysterious right now. And we really don't know what's going on. What exactly is the injury? How long is he going to be out? And we talked about this the last time we did the pod, how much pressure they put on him to play through some of these injuries and how much pressure he puts on himself to fight that street clothes narrative. And just what's your feel right now about what's going on with that? How dangerous is it going to be to bring him back, a big guy with a foot injury that always kind of raises my antennas? And how is that going to impact beyond just this season, their future? Because he is their future. Even though LeBron's still great, we know their future is dependent upon AD. So just what are you hearing as far as just what's going on with AD?
Yeah, well, it sounded like he was going to be out at least a few weeks. I know he's going to be reevaluated coming up within the next week or so. But Shams reported, you know, a stress reaction injury in his foot. So I think it's at least not broken, which are obviously be worse and have him out for a while. But I think the Lakers really got to be careful here because with AD, we've seen he has these random, you know, lower extremity injuries that just kind of happen on freak plays. And he is the future of this franchise for at least the next few years. So I think it's been a nice bounce back season for him. This is the best, definitely the best he's played in LA, but arguably the best he's played in his career. I mean, maybe that there was a better season in New Orleans, but he's up there. You know, it's pretty close. So like, I think you've at least got him in the right headspace and kind of figured things out on how to maximize him. Now it's just keeping him healthy and really, I think, building the roster around him moving forward, which I think they've primarily built around LeBron more so than AD. And it's kind of been, let's fit AD in here. But I think you really saw a passing of the torch this season, and LeBron kind of alluded to it a couple times. And I think a lot of times LeBron had mentioned it, but you hadn't really seen it on the court. And you finally saw that these last few weeks before the injury, where the pecking order shifted. And really, for the first time in LeBron's career, because even that Miami year, like technically it was still D Wade's team, but like LeBron was still LeBron, and you know, up until the finals. And I think this was the first time in LeBron's career he's really been the number two. And that was a shift on his part. That was a shift for AD, and really just a shift for the organization, where Darvin Ham was openly talking about AD is our best player. And you know, you just don't hear that on a LeBron team. So I think the organization has gone through a change this season as well, kind of with that dynamic. But you know, moving forward, I think they really got to be careful with AD, because again, you're 6 games under .500. Like right now, you're not even in the play-in tournament. Is it worth bringing him back and potentially him suffering a setback, a serious setback that could cost him the rest of the season, could cost them into next season? I mean, there's still the possibility of surgery at some point. So I think for them, that they got to, it's a weird thing where they got to have patience, but they obviously don't have the time for patience, and they're in a bit of a hole right now. But I don't, you know, it might be a situation where you just have to take the L on this season and then kind of regroup next year.
Is there like concern that AD is old enough at this point that like if he gets hurt and misses a season, you might miss his prime?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's going to be 30 in March. So he's right there age wise. I think, and that's kind of the thing, is like, I think they got to be really careful with this, where you just don't make it something that, because with AD, it's stuff's kind of lingered with his knees and, you know, with his feet. Like, he's had several of these injuries over the last 2 years. I feel like they've kind of compounded and kind of led to, I mean, I'm sure you guys saw the play, but like, it was a freak thing where he jumps up, he's in the air, his foot gets caught on Nikola Jokic's calf, and that is what causes this injury. Like, you rarely see an in-air injury like that. It's usually the landing. That's a guy gets
leave
injured.
It to AD to pull that off.
I was gonna say AD finds a way to get a weird injury, man. He leads the league in them.
But the crazy thing is, you know, to in a macro level, like we were just talking about the Pelicans and how bright their future is. They might be getting a top five pick from the Lakers because of this whole situation. Like that's insane. Imagine adding Wemby to the Pelicans roster. Like, and I know people have been joking about that all season, but like, we're almost at the halfway point of the season, and that's a real possibility.
No doubt. And people around this team are constantly having that conversation about the Lakers pick. They talk about that more than their own team.
What's the protection on it again? Because they're at 7 right now.
It's a swap.
No protection.
No protection.
Yeah, it's a swap.
No,
swap, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Next year is no protection. This year is a swap.
That's right. So, wow. And what's funny is the Pelicans don't need a Wemby or Scoot. I mean, Scoot would be great, obviously, but just any top 10 level talent adding to what they have already, it's insane. They're going to be in a similar situation like where Boston is right now, where they have so much talent, their payroll's already so inflated that they're making tough decisions on some of these guys just because they don't want to pay $1 billion in tax. And I don't know what New Orleans' appetite is for that level of tax. We already know what the Lakers and the Clippers are. New Orleans is kind of that big one in the NBA where you're going to find out like how deep are they willing to dive.
I got a quick question for you guys. And this is kind of as objective outside parties. Would you make a trade if you were the Lakers? Like, do you think this season is worth trying to save and having, like, let's say an optimistic scenario, AD's back within the next few weeks. Lakers can kind of tread water, stay a few games under .500, and they're a couple games out of the play-in, and it's, let's say it's late January. Do you throw a pick or two on the table to upgrade the roster with a small move or maybe a big move? Or do you just say, you know, if we make the plan, we make the plan, but we're not going to mess up our future, you know, draft capital to try to fix what's clearly a team that's at best going to like make the playoffs, but probably lose in the first round.
They need to bite the bullet, man, and just suck it up and get through this season. Because like you said, like if the fact that we're talking about Anthony Davis as anyone's future when he's turning 30 in March and a year 11, 30 at that, I don't think that's good business. If you're the Lakers, man, just get through this season. Russ's money comes off the books. You keep your first round picks, and you know, you give Rob Pelinka yet another chance to create some kind of sensible roster. I mean, he did it once out of what, four times. So that's really the move right there.
Yeah, I think anytime you ask, should they make a trade? I think the obvious reaction is, well, trade for who? What's the trade, right? And I think as of right now, it looks like Miles Turner is looking like more likely he's going to re-sign in Indy than get traded to LA. So that's one guy off the list. DeRozan's been hanging around there. I don't know if DeRozan really moves the needle for you that much if you're the Lakers, as great as he is. I'm with Law. I feel like you got to just bite the bullet on this season and just regroup in the summer and see if you can get somebody else. Maybe you can have less drama in your organization and bring Kyrie around, right? That'll calm everything down. That'll less headlines for Jovan. So that'll be great.
I mean, can they even afford Kyrie at this point? Look at what the Nets are doing. I think that his value probably is too high now, unless they're going to give 2 to 3 picks, which they made it clear they weren't going to do. And Miles Turner, I don't know about likelihood of extension, but he's looking for a pretty sizable contract after seeing what some of these guys got in free agency. So the Lakers, are they going to pay that? I can't imagine that they're going to give him that deal. Are they going to give him $130 million with their tax situation? Although, I mean, how bad is their tax situation in the future? I mean, Jovan's shaking his head. It seems like that would be prohibitive.
I mean, they're projected to have about $30-ish million in cap space this offseason. So, from my understanding, if they do trade for Miles, it would be with the expectation that they are going to come to some sort of extension. Like, mm-hmm. they would only acquire him if they were going to extend him. Like, they wouldn't want it to be a half season rental. It would have to be a long term thing where those terms would have to be. It's kind of, you can't really negotiate it if you're the Lakers or. They couldn't extend him now, correct? They would have to be in the offseason. But he could extend with the Pacers currently. The expectation would be that they would be keeping him for the long run. But yeah, I mean, Darvin Ham has even mentioned it, which you rarely see a coach mentioning it, but he's mentioned the repeater tax and some of the tax limitations with this group. So I think for this season, it's a bit of a concern, but I think moving forward with a clean slate, they're not as concerned. I mean, they could sign Kyrie next summer. Like, I think that's a realistic possibility, depending on kind of what, you know, how the rest of the season goes. But yeah, I mean, I think for them, they're trying to weigh also like how much long term salary, because you can make a move like, you know, would they take on Evan Fournier from New York? And you know, they love Cam Reddish. They've been wanting Cam Reddish for a while.
Why?
But like, do you want to take on those multiple years of Evan Fournier? Like that's a legitimate question for them. So I think that there's ways to upgrade the roster. It's just, again, is that worth a first round pick? If not, potentially two. And I think at this point, probably not with what's out there, but it also depends how the deadline shakes out.
I mean, those guys aren't even playing for the Knicks. Like, why would you have to give up anything besides a second? Well, whatever. All right, let's get out of here in a minute. Before we do, we just want to quickly touch on the Clips, especially now that the news came out literally 5 seconds ago of our recording that Devin Booker is out for a month with a groin strain. So, the Clips just passed the Suns in the standings. That's kind of neck and neck thing this year. What is the momentum right now for the Clippers, Law?
The Clippers are such a nasty basketball team to watch this year. Like,
good nasty or bad nasty?
You know what? For the most part, it benefits the Clippers because they're so good defensively. They junk the game up. They are dedicated to taking your free throws away, taking your threes away. They make you play uncomfortable basketball. It's just uncomfortable to watch because their offense is so out of control that they don't hang on the leads that they're supposed to, or they just simply... They only play good offense for the 10 minutes necessary to execute a comeback. But because they're playing so much better lately, and again, Kawhi Leonard's return correlates with that, they are in fourth. they are in shouting distance of the top three in the West. And that's a problem for the West, considering that the Clippers, they have rarely played a complete game. Again, Jared, when you were here in LA and you saw the Celtics game, I was shocked that that's the only game all year that the Clippers won each of the four quarters. The only game all year out of 36, and yet they are still showing that they have room for improvement. That the fact that they're damn near a 60% win team and they still haven't quite clicked, and they have this thing where the teams below them were just, you know, I didn't have the nicest thing to say about the Mavericks as a team. They're six. The Suns are fifth, and they're missing two starters long term, Cameron Johnson being the other addition to the book. I mean, the Sacramento Kings are slipping a bit, and they don't have Domantas Sabonis. He's dealing with a hand injury himself. Like, the Clippers aren't in a whole lot of danger of slipping. They have every opportunity to move up. And so this is a big evaluation time, because, as you know, they're super deep. That does not mean that the roster makes a whole lot of sense. So they're going to be looking pretty hard as January approaches, as we get through January, at what they can do to optimize this roster for the postseason. Because I'm not totally convinced that the roster you see now is the roster that you see in the spring.
Interesting. All right, we got to wrap it up here. That was Law Murray. Will Guillory is our Pelicans writer. Law Murray is our Clippers writer. Jovan Buha covers the Lakers for The Athletic. And big shouts to Tim Cato for coming on after he finished his recovery beer after what I'm sure was a long night at the, is it American Airlines Center or Arena? I forget which one it is in Dallas.
I believe Center.
Center. Okay. I mean, Cato's at the center of it all. We know that. Andrew Schlecht is our producer. Shout out to Shams for his verbal inside pass. And this is it for Young Ones. This is it for 2022. This is the Athletic NBA Show. I'm Jared Weiss. We'll see you next time.